glad you could join me for this Yin Radio show. We have today an encore presentation of a show that aired this summer, and it's on a particularly perfect summer sport so that we can remind you of those glorious days of summer, even while we're in the midst of winter. The theme is softball. This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. And I have a brand new show for you today on a great summer topic, softball. I have two pieces for you and some great music on that theme. First is a short fictional story about a young woman who is struggling to redefine herself when she realizes that her all-too-short softball career was going to end after college. That piece is followed by a campfire conversation among players on a local recreational league and all-star players who've made some spectacular plays. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio with a show on the topic of softball. Anna Fortner writes fiction, short stories, many of which involve sport, surfing, rafting, and softball, for instance. She recently read her short story, This is Softball, for Yin Radio, and it makes the main component of today's Yin Radio show. Installment number one, author Anna Fortner reads her story.
This is softball. Today is the first time in 5 months that Marin has seen the sun, a faint yellow ball on the horizon. It warms her face and brightens the snow all around her. She pulls her long black hair into a ponytail, leans over, and runs her hands down her calves. Beads of sweat turn on their trajectory towards her mouth and run instead to her eyes. She squeezes them tight and stretches her fingers to the ground, laying her palms flat on home plate. An ache rests in Marin's muscles, but she isn't sore, even though she's run every day for the last month, long and hard runs that take her on the few lighted streets in the borough and around the school's track field again and again. Her body aches not from being used, but from a desire to be used, to burn and sweat and hurt, and not in the way a run can provide, gentle and consistent, but the way her body is accustomed to, in the bursts and twists and turns of softball. The wind rattles the chain-link fence. Without opening her eyes, Marin stands, turns her body a few degrees to the right, and places her left foot slightly behind her. She breathes in salty air, and on the exhale she takes off, building to a full sprint. Elbows in and head down, she counts the steps. At the gentle rise of first base below her foot, she doesn't stop and she doesn't turn toward second. Marin continues into the gravel outfield through patches of ice and snow. She stops when the frigid Arctic waters flood her shoes. The cold is almost unbearable, but soon enough she loses feeling altogether. Her breathing subsides and voices emerge. Beneath an arc made by two whale ribs are a boy and girl, 15, maybe 16 years old. Teenagers are still without a sense of time, still wild from the darkness of winter. They live without a care for the day or its hour, going out when they are not tired, which is most of the time, and resting when they are. The boy and girl have a bottle of something, probably vodka, stolen from a parent who bought it off one of the planes that make regular trips to the dry communities of the North Slope. The boy takes the bottle and tilts back his head. He drinks it like water, letting his cheeks fill before swallowing. He passes the bottle to the girl. Her hair is long and dark. She tucks it behind her right ear. Marin knows her, but from where? Tryouts. What is her name? Teresa? Yes, Teresa. Their first meeting was last week in the semi-darkness of the bleachers at Pavic Park. The girls trickled in slowly at first. The sixth-grade girls with their hair in long braids were early. They slid pastel-colored bags off their shoulders that made heavy, reverberating thuds when they hit steel. A flood of students showed up 2 minutes after, seventh and eighth grade girls in blue jeans and sweatshirts. Finally, the high school girls with dark eyeliner, red lipstick, and exposed midriffs arrived, one of them Teresa. They stood at the edge of the bleachers, arms crossed against their chests, a challenge. "No one is forcing you to be here," Marin thought, "and I could care less if you are." Marin tried to place herself as a teenager in one of these groups, but she couldn't. Her talent had always made her different, superior. Marin cleared her throat to get their attention. "So you're all here." She stopped. She wasn't sure what to say. Being a coach was nothing like being a player. "Because you want to play softball, right?" Some girls nodded their heads. Others muttered in agreement, and some laughed as if to say, "Isn't that obvious?" Marin ran a hand down the buttons of her blouse. "Good. Let's start with introductions, then. My name is Marin Forsyth." Marin paused to consider what she should tell them about herself. "I grew up here. In May, I graduated from UCLA, where I played Division I softball." Teresa raised her left hand and held it aloft like it was attached to a string and her body was suspended, gravity pulling her head and right arm towards the ground. It was the way Marin remembered kids in the back of the classroom raising their hands when they were about to challenge the teacher. Marin braced herself. "Yes," she said. "Why'd you come back here?" Marin's armpits dampened. She said the first thing that came to mind, a truth revelatory of nothing. "Because I was broke?" Teresa scoffed. "That wouldn't be enough to get me back here." Marin laughed with the others, but what she wanted to do was pull her visor from her head, shove it in Teresa's face, and tell her she wasn't what she thought. Washed up at 22. She wanted to tell Teresa that she'd be devoured by the world outside the borough, that her eyeliner and lipstick, her willingness to spread her legs for any man, would get her nowhere. The girl's naivete calmed Marin, and in her calm, she allowed herself to acknowledge that she had proven to be incapable of surviving outside the borough, so she was in no position to judge Teresa. Marin steps back from the edge of the water, hoping to go unnoticed. But Marin can tell Teresa has recognized her because she points a finger in Marin's direction and says something to the boy, and they both laugh. Then, for no reason Marin can discern, the boy throws the vodka bottle high into the air, and they all watch it hit one of the rib bones and splinter into 100 tiny pieces that do not glitter in the dim sun. Just inside the entrance to the library, Marin stops and wipes the sweat from her face with the bottom of her sweatshirt. The library is empty except for a custodian wiping down the drinking fountain with a rag and a librarian organizing chairs around an orange table. The librarian smiles and says, "Long time no see, Marin." It's meant to be a joke. For the last 3 months of the dark Alaska winter, up until just a few days ago, Marin spent every day in the library because she knew no one would bother her here. She didn't want to run into old friends, which is near impossible on the streets of the borough. She didn't want to deal with their questions, with their realization that she was just like them now, condemned to a life in the borough. In the most private corner, in a section titled Native Literature, Marin hid. She pulled books from the shelves at random, suddenly aware she had no preference for one subject over another. Her life had always been softball. She did well in high school only because she was motivated by the necessity of an athletic scholarship. The subject she studied was arbitrary, the grade everything. At UCLA, Marin spent her time in the weight room, on her back in the trainer's office with an ice pack saran wrapped to her right shoulder, on an airplane or bus on her way to a game, standing on the mound and pacing in the dugout. She majored in history because she was told most athletes found it manageable. In the borough's library, Marin convinced herself that she was making up for lost time, that she needed to find other interests. But in the end, her time in the library became a kind of hibernation, a time marked only by facts retained from the books near at hand. Marin chooses the computer terminal closest to the door and sits down. She types in her username and password and pulls her wool hat from her head. She has one email. It reads, "Regarding March 21st, 7:30 a.m. We scrimmage Canada tomorrow. Send breath, strength, your talent. UPS cheaper than FedEx. Down with meat. Susie." Below is Marin's original message. "March 21st, 7:30 a.m. I stopped eating meat 3 days ago. I read that the Inuit say the great peril of our existence lies in the fact that our diet consists entirely of souls. This seems true. They had no choice, but I do. I wonder how much someone can give up before they disappear entirely. Marin." At the door, Marin pauses to put on her gloves and wool hat. Through the glass, she can see the sun is gone again. She finds relief in this. It is easier to do nothing in the dark. 2. Marin tosses her running shoes and socks into the corner by the front door and steps into the living room where the television is turned to one of the daytime soap operas her mom watches. Marin's dad installed cable, the kind that gets shows from all over the world and with which it is possible to find most anything at any time of day. Marin's mom has managed to find soaps from 7 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. Marin falls into her dad's recliner and pulls his slippers over her toes, burning with a return of feeling. On the television, a little girl with blonde pigtails is pulling her diaper on and off. "I did it," she squeals, hands over her head. Television in the morning overwhelms Marin with sadness. She thinks, 5 hours. I have 5 hours until practice. How do you fill a day? Marin points the remote at the television and hits mute. "Hey," Marin's mom calls, "I'm listening to that." Marin finds her mom making the bed in the master bedroom, wisps of statically charged gray hair sticking out from her head. Her mom lifts her arms, snapping the pale yellow top sheet out over the mattress, and bends to tuck in the corners. Marin lies on the edge of the bed. "Marin, honey, please get up." It's a simple request, Marin knows, but she doesn't do as her mom asks. Marin's mom kneels in front of her. "What's going on?" she asks. "Nothing," Marin says. The sound of her own voice surprises her. It is the first time she has spoken since last night. "Then why do you insist on always being in my way?" Marin drapes an arm over her eyes. "Well?" She wants something from her mom, but she doesn't know what. She and her mom have always got along, and since Marin returned home for good, her mom has treated her no differently than she did in the past. But at times like this, when her sadness turns to agitation, when her skin is too tight and her bones too heavy, Marin needs her mother to know what to give her. But she doesn't. Ever. "You have a sickness," Marin says. "What on earth are you talking about?" "I think you're sick." Her mom rises to her feet. "All right, Marin, what have I got?" "The disease with no name."
"My disease doesn't have a name?"
"No, that is its name. The disease with no name. I learned about it in a women's studies class. It's what you get when you only do housework and watch soap operas." "Good grief, Marin," her mom tucks in another corner. "Please get off the bed. The disease can be fatal." "Off. It makes you slit your wrists or down a bottle of Tylenol, too, if you really mean it." "That's enough, Marin." "I'm bored," Marin says and rolls over, her face flat against the sheet. It is still warm from the dryer and smells strongly of detergent. "You just got back from a run. How can you be bored already?" Marin shrugs her shoulders. Her mom sighs and lies down, her head on the back of Marin's arm. "I know this probably sounds silly, but you could join the adult league. You could probably even be on me and your dad's team," Marin's mom says. "Personally, I think carbon monoxide poisoning is the way to go. Life's painful enough." Marin turns her head. The inside of her mom's ear is shiny. "You should use Q-tips more often," she says. Marin's mom runs her pinky around the canal of her ear. "You could also be more helpful around here. You're only as bored as you let yourself be," she says. Marin turns her face back against the sheet. Marin's mom says, "Practice starts soon, right? That'll add a little excitement to your day." "Yes," Marin thinks. "What could be more exciting than standing around watching a bunch of inept teenage girls play softball?" She clears her throat. "I quit."
"Marin, you can't. You told Pamela."
"I know," she sighs heavily. "Well, that means you only have to entertain yourself for half a day. Think you can manage?"
"More like 3/4 of a day," Marin replies.
"Don't be so dramatic," her mom says and gets up. "Besides, there are a few hours of light now." A pillow lands on Marin's head and then another. Marin sits up. Her mom is standing in the doorway watching her. "What?" Marin says.
"You tell me."
"Nothing," Marin replies.
"Put the comforter on when you're done," her mom says. In the silence that follows her mom's exit, Marin can hear the ticking of her father's alarm clock. She lies back down and pulls a pillow over her face. When she is sure her mom is out of earshot, she screams into the pillow.
3. Marin pulls her mom's car into a space in the parking lot and turns off the engine. Through the windshield, she can see a few girls sitting in the bleachers, waiting. "For me," she thinks, "because I am the coach." In her office last week, Marin's old principal, Pamela Evelwood, told her,
You went through the suicide prevention talks and the drug and alcohol abuse awareness programs when you were their age, Maren. What these girls need is a role model, someone young and vibrant and successful, someone like you. Maren considered her words. She knew there was nothing to do but what you're told not to, that most of these girls already broke the rules, that the others were on the verge of doing so. But things had been different for Maren. When she was a kid, her success, the way she could always run faster than most of the boys and certainly all of the girls, the way she could control the power that shot down her arm like a swarm of bees forced suddenly through a funnel and into the softball just as she let it go, convinced her her future was malleable, and she embraced her identity as an athlete. Her self-confidence made it easy to stay home when others her age were out partying, and ultimately made her one of only two students to leave the borough for college in the lower 48. But whether this confidence turned out in the end to be a good thing, Maren wasn't sure anymore. Maren unlocks the shed next to the bleachers and pulls out a couple of bats and a bucket of balls. She knows the girls are watching her now, that she should acknowledge them with a hello. But then she'd have to act cheery, and that isn't how she's feeling. And cheeriness only leads to idle chit-chat that Maren finds unbearable. So she shoulders the bats and grabs the bucket by the handle and carries them to home plate without saying a word. Maren checks her watch. She calls the girls from the bleachers to the outfield and tells them to stretch their quads, but the girls look at her without moving, and it occurs to Maren they probably don't know what quads are, let alone how to stretch them. The realization that she will have to start with the most basic explanations of softball exhausts Maren. She tells the girls how susceptible their quads are to a strain until they are in shape, that for balance they should focus their eyes on a blade of grass, or as is the case in the burrow, a piece of gravel. Maren lifts her right foot behind her and holds it with her left hand. Your quad is the front of your thigh. If staring at a piece of gravel doesn't work, put a hand on the shoulder of the person next to you. The girls make a circle. When the girls have stretched both quads, Maren tells them to take four laps around the field. The older girls groan and say, "Four? How about three?" The younger ones wait for Maren to respond. "I'm not here to argue," Maren says. "If you want to just hang out, that's fine with me. Makes my life easier." The girls look at each other, then back at Maren. Eventually, an older girl starts to run, and the rest fall in behind her. Maren is vaguely disappointed. Maren walks to the pitcher's mound and tucks her hands deep in the pockets of her down jacket. She watches the pack of girls pass. They run hunched over, their elbows jutting out in all directions. "They are probably calling me a bitch right now," Maren thinks. She did not intend to be harsh with them. "I will be nice," she tells herself. "It's my job to be nice." But she knows even as she tells herself this, she won't behave any differently. She has ceased to believe that she is in control of anything. A strong offshore wind kicks up, pushing black-bottomed rain clouds toward shore. The cold pushes through Maren's jeans. She shudders and tucks her chin inside her jacket. The warmth of her breath circles her neck and disappears. She checks her watch. It is now 10 after. It is startling that so little time has passed. Maren imagines her life spread out before her in a series of 10-minute increments and wishes desperately for something to happen. A car accident, a bear mauling, to break up the monotony. She can think of nothing good that might occur. The girls are passing third for the second time when a cloud of dust from the parking lot engulfs them. The girls raise their hands to their faces and scream and laugh when they run into one another. When the dust reaches her, Maren lowers her head. She watches bits of gravel hit her chest and fall to the ground. She imagines the dust is her own, imagines that pieces of her are swept up in the cloud and carried higher and higher until she is over the beach and then the sea, nothing but a light blue above and a dark blue below. The gust passes and Maren raises her head. The girls are standing around the dugout, picking at their eyes with their fingers. Later, in the library, Maren writes, March 23rd, 12:32 p.m. I can feel the computer keys beneath my fingers and the chair beneath my legs. I remember the pain of losses and the joy of wins, but inside I am empty now. I remember who I was, but I don't know who I am. Maren. 4. Early the next morning, Maren runs north along the coast. Her shoes are still damp from the morning before, but it doesn't make much difference since the snow along the beach soaks them through 10 minutes into her run. It is colder this morning and grayer. A thick blanket of cloud blocks the sun and dulls the ocean water. Marin watches the ground in front of her feet and tries to stick to the most well-traveled tire tracks. Her calves are already burning with the effort of pushing off loose gravel. Behind her, the smoke from the oil refinery is the only indication that Marin is not alone. She remembers the once familiar slowing of her pace, a thickening of the air. She reaches out with her arms like she used to, cuts herself an imaginary box with her hands. "My space," she mutters under her breath. In high school, this is how she kept going when her biggest fears were of caribou and bear. On long runs, the fear gathered strength, pushed on her chest and arms undetectably until Marin found she was plodding along. In her mind's eye, the material of the box always radiated pale lavender and was slick like a soap bubble but tough like gum. The fear was a green mist, and the moose and bear nebulous clouds of brown heat dispersed across the landscape. She would zoom in on each, her mind like a camera, and watch the elk and polar bear raise their heads, her box a minor disturbance, a faint scent in the air, a slight breeze on their backs, but nothing more, and then she would run faster. An hour outside of town, Marin reaches a sign. It reads, "Danger, polar bears, no vehicles beyond this point. Please help reduce the risk of human injury." She stops, places her hands on her waist, circles twice and sees nothing but gravel and ocean and sign. There are no tire tracks. Wind blows salt water into the air. It sticks to Marin's face like clay. She walks beyond the sign to the place where gravel meets ice pack. She reaches out with her foot and taps the ice with her toe. It makes a dull thud. When she was a young girl, kids challenged each other to walk out on the pack, to inch your way further and further from shore until panic seized you or your parents showed up to call you back and reprimand you. But that was years ago, and the ice has been weakening, so kids don't try it much anymore unless they are drunk and feeling brave. Marin places her foot on the ice and shifts her weight. She hears nothing but the wind. She places the other foot on the ice and holds her breath. Adrenaline tingles in her arms. She takes a small step and another, then stops to listen. Still, only wind. She closes her eyes and sees herself in a vast expanse of white. No ocean, no gravel, no sign. Marin lowers herself to her knees and then her stomach and rolls onto her back. She exhales loudly. The cold of the ice soaks through her clothing and reaches the least muscular parts of her body first, her elbows and the small of her back. Through the ice, she thinks she can hear the ocean flowing toward shore, like water sloshing in an empty stomach. When the cold becomes too much, Marin rolls back onto her stomach. The sudden rush of blood to her brain quickens her heart. A loud thump, thump, thump pulses in her ears, followed by a splash. Marin looks up. 20 yards to her right, a polar bear is on her stomach too, inching closer to an opening in the ice pack. Behind her, two cubs bat at one another on a mound of snow. Vomit rises in Marin's stomach and hovers in the back of her throat. Her breathing is shallow and erratic. When she is certain the bears are unaware of her, Marin rises to her knees. But then her head starts to spin and the ice tilts and she falls forward onto her hands. She hears the ice cracking first, then watches her right hand splash into the water. The water rises, forearm, elbow, shoulder, and stops. Slowly she pulls her arm out and slides away from the hole. When her feet hit dry land, she runs as hard as she can until she can finally see cars moving along the coastal roads of the borough. She stops, hands on her knees, and vomits into the gravel until her stomach is empty, and then she dry heaves. She knows that she is safe now, that the polar bears are far behind her, but she cannot shake the terrible awareness of her mortality. 3 months ago, Marin finally worked up the courage to tell her parents that she wasn't just home for a visit, but would be staying indefinitely. Her mom asked no questions and left the dinner table to put fresh sheets on Marin's bed. Her father pushed away his half-eaten burger, ran a hand over his mustache, and crossed his arms against his chest. Marin felt the blood rising in her face. The sound of the coffee maker percolating startled her. Marin was wondering if her mother had turned it on when she got up from the table or if it was preset when her father asked, "What do you mean, Marin? I just want to be sure I've got this straight." Marin didn't speak. She didn't know what more she could say. Softball had always come naturally to her. She had never needed special tips from her father as a young girl, when he might still have known more than her about softball from his half-dozen seasons in the adult league, and he never offered to play catch with her or pitch ball so she could practice batting. It wasn't that he didn't have time. He chose not to help her because it allowed him to stand along the fence at every game and say, It's God-given. I don't have to do a thing. Marin knew he couldn't reconcile the girl who left his house at 18 with the one sitting across from him at 22. The girl you knew and loved is gone. Dead, she wanted to tell him. She wanted to justify her failure, wanted to ask him how she was supposed to perform under the greatest pressure of her life. The realization that making the Olympic team could guarantee another 4 years of softball, and not making it guaranteed she would never play again. There's no major league, no minor league, nothing. But when the coffee maker beeped and her father got up to pour himself a cup, Marin stumbled away from the table, grabbed her running shoes, and let the door slam behind her. She didn't come back until she had calmed, well after everyone was in bed. In the library, her fingers stiff and unfeeling, and her right forearm bleeding, Marin reads, regarding March 23rd, 12:32 p.m. Marin, I don't understand what's going on. You've got me worried. You are not stuck in Alaska forever. Softball is not everything. Let me help you. Be clear and concise. Drop the poetics. Susie. Marin is both relieved and disgusted by the email. How did I end up in this position? The taste of vomit still ripe in her mouth, Marin replies, "Okay, I hope you're right."
We'll be back to the story, This is Softball by Anna Fortner, in just a moment. This is Yin Radio, and we've been listening to Anna Fortner's fictional work, This is Softball. In the story, Marin has left college and her softball career. She's returned to her small Alaska hometown to live with her parents and coach summer softball. She's dedicated herself to softball through high school, gaining a college scholarship. With no professional league, Marin sees her purpose, her reason for living, gone. Marin is struggling, feeling like a failure. Let's rejoin the story. This is Softball.
5. Are you going tonight? Teresa asks. To Jared's? Asks Abby. They are sitting on their jackets, their right leg stretched out in front of them. Yeah. Who isn't? He and Theo got so much alcohol in Chipkin this weekend. Marin walks around the group, watches a younger girl stretch and pretend not to listen. She knows what Abby and Teresa are up to. It's a challenge, their way of seeing how far they can push Marin, how much they can shock her. And Marin knows it's her job to have a response that will establish her as someone that girls can both trust and respect as an authority figure. You still seeing Max? Teresa asks. Yeah, Abby says. He's such a jerk, though. I can't keep him off me. Abby is smiling as she says this, and Marin wonders if for Abby this incongruity in her relationship with her boyfriend is proof that she is an adult. She wonders if there is any indicator of adulthood that isn't painful. You should see me, Teresa says. I can't keep my hands off Tommy. Marin's coach at UCLA would bench anyone who so much as whispered the words alcohol and boyfriend at practice. The older girls had told Marin and the others so much before their first practice, but Susie didn't listen or forgot. Marin isn't quite sure anymore. So Susie told Marin while they were standing in the outfield in the heat of the afternoon, shagging balls during batting practice, that she heard there was going to be a party on the first floor of their dorm, and as a consequence, Marin didn't so much as touch a bat her first game, even though she had been so heavily recruited. Susie never made the same mistake, and it was partly because they spent that first game sitting next to each other on the bench that she and Susie became such good friends. Marin does not feel any investment in these girls, certainly nothing like her coach must have felt in her team, but perhaps a small effort on her part might engender it. Abby, Teresa, why don't you take a lap, Marin says, and when you get back, be ready to focus on softball. 6. You're a celebrity in the borough, Marin's mom says. She drops the lid of the toilet and sits down. She has a dish towel in her hand. Don't you think it might be at least a little bit fun? Marin slides lower in the tub. Her mom drapes the dish towel across her lap and folds it into a square. She shakes it out and does it again. Should I be worried about you, Marin? Marin wipes sweat from her face with her wet hand. The television in the living room grows suddenly louder when the commercials come on. Give me a reason not to be, Marin. 7:30 tonight. One game. That's all I'm asking. If you don't like it, I won't ask again. Please. For me. The girl with a diaper is squealing again. Whoopee, a celebrity in the borough, Marin says. Thank you, her mom says. I'll leave you alone now. Marin takes a deep breath and sinks into the water. 7. Marin adjusts the ball with her fingers until the spine feels right in her palm and turns to check if her team is ready. A green fog is blowing in, but Marin can still make out the jerseys of the outfielders, the same bright yellow of the sign above the Old Woman of the Sea Cafe on Main, their sponsor. Her mom is playing shortstop. She has on a pair of Marin's old pants and cleats. She is bending at the knees and rocking from one foot to the other. Marin's father is at second, punching his right hand into his gloved left. Marin turns back towards home. The man at bat has a ponytail and a beer gut. What am I doing here? Marin thinks. The man steps away from home plate to take a few practice swings. The bleachers are unusually crowded, full of people unrecognizable in their hooded jackets. Marin wonders if they are here to see her. The batter with the beer gut steps back to home and readies himself. Marin brings the ball towards her chest and shields it with her glove. She inhales deeply. In a flash, her arm unwinds from her chest and the ball flies towards home. The catcher holds the ball in one hand and pulls the other from his glove, shaking it like it's on fire. Damn, he says. God damn. The crowd laughs and cheers. The catcher throws the ball back to Marin and puts his batting glove on under his mitt before he squats down behind home again. Easy now, girl, he says, pulling on his mask. Marin smiles. She is acutely aware of how awkward it feels to do so. Marin strikes out the batter with ease, 3 perfect pitches in a row. Damn right, one of Marin's teammates says. What'd you expect? To her surprise, Marin is having something like fun. Not the kind of euphoria she felt in college when the fate of her team was in her hands, when she knew she couldn't fail and that she wouldn't, that in a moment her team and fans would flood the field, and that she would be amazed life could be so good. It's nothing like that, but what she's feeling is familiar, and nothing about her life has been familiar in a long time. She strikes out the next batter. 3 more perfect pitches. Even the opposing team is cheering Marin on. The third batter, a short woman with a long dark ponytail down her back, walks to home. Marin whizzes a ball by her. 2 more, Marin's team says. Shut 'em out. Marin throws another strike. But it seems Marin has gone too far for the opposing team. Come on now, they say, this is for fun. Another player adds, yeah, this is just an adult league. She's never played before, for Christ's sake. He points to the woman at bat. Marin's dad laughs. You may not be having any fun, he says, but we are. He winks at Marin. Strike him out, sweetheart. Marin smiles at him and nods. The woman timidly straddles home and pushes her helmet away from her eyes. Marin brings the ball to her chest, imagines bees, and releases a fastball. The batter swings and misses. Beneath the cheers of her teammates are the boos of the opposing team and of the crowd. Some of them are up on their feet, hands cupped around their mouths. It's so quick, Marin thinks. One moment your life is familiar, your future inevitable, and the next it isn't. All it takes is heckling from a man 20 years your senior, a list without your name on it, a pat on the back, and to see you in 4 years. Then you watch parts of your life drop like stones until all you have left is a body you don't know what to do with anymore. 1 outfielder, then another sprints by Marin. Bear, one of them shouts. Polar bear. Marin's dad slaps his glove against his thigh. Shoot, he says, we were going to win this one. Marin's mother jogs by, grabs his arm, and pulls herself close. "Come on, Mar, hurry up," she calls, but Marin doesn't move. The bear continues to walk towards the infield, her body taking definite form. Marin can see her dark eyes and nose, the shifting of her muscles beneath her coat with each step. "Marin," her mom calls, "get over here." Her mother is on the other side of the fence. The field is empty now of everyone except her. People are yelling, "Go away, bear, get out of here," and honking car horns. The bear is on her hind feet, her nose high in the air. Marin steps back. Adrenaline burns in the center of her chest. The bear falls back onto her front paws and continues towards the infield. She stops, looks back where she came from. Her two cubs are behind her, the firm grip of two hands on Marin's arm, and her father's voice pulls her back. "What the hell are you doing?" he asks. "Trying to get yourself killed?" She looks her dad square in the face. She wants to know if this is a serious question. For a moment, he stops and meets Marin's gaze. She thinks his eyes widen, that a twitch in the corner of his mouth means he understands. But before she can be sure, he has turned away from Marin and is dragging her towards her mom. When they reach Marin's mom, she is visibly shaken. "What is it, Marin? What is it that has you behaving this way?" Marin smiles. "It's nothing," she says. 8. The next morning, the ocean reflects the clear blue of the sky, and the sun warms Marin's skin despite the still cool offshore wind. Marin pulls her wool cap from her head and shoves it in the pocket of her sweatshirt. She picks up her pace. When the sign comes into view again, she stops. As she expected, the polar bear and her two cubs are on the ice pack. Thousands of miles away, Susie, still sweaty from practice, is sitting in front of her computer reading an email. April 25th, 7:30 a.m. Some Inuit tribes were known to leave the old to die on the ice in times of extreme food shortages. They never forced the old to do this. The old, sensing their usefulness had passed, voluntarily separated themselves from the tribe. Marin.
Anna Fortner read her short story, "This is Softball," for Yin Radio. In addition to writing fiction, Anna teaches writing and language arts at a private boarding school in Santa Barbara, California. On July 17, 2009, Anna won the USA Mountain Bike National Championship in Sol Vista, Colorado. She was racing in the women's expert division. Time to go pro, Anna. You can learn more about this part of Anna's exploits at www.solvistanationals.com or at usacycling.org or at www.cyclingdirt.org. Installment number 2. Softball is a staple of summer. Recreational leagues draw thousands. Women in Moscow, Idaho, and Pullman, Washington had a barbecue to celebrate the end of the season after an All-Stars game. Sitting around a campfire, these All-Stars had a conversation about softball, and we share it with you in installment number 2. How long have you been playing softball?
How long, Summer? 4 years.
And what is one of the wildest things that's happened while you played? Either a great injury or a great play you've made? Tell me the greatest play you made.
I learned not to slide in the first base.
Tell the story. Yeah, tell me. Tell me. I haven't heard it.
Nope.
Will somebody else tell it for her?
Sometimes
behind her back?
We need to learn the hard way.
Who wants to tell? Why did you slide there anyway? Is it your first year?
That was magical juice.
I think it was.
I don't know. Let's pretend it was.
It wasn't the year that Mom tripped over first base and went, dun, 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 dun.
I remember that. That was 2 years ago.
That was my mother. No.
Oh.
Good job.
Who wants to go next? What's the wildest thing that's ever happened on softball? You've been playing?
Yes. I've been playing softball since I was 18.
Oh, really?
So I don't know. That's over 30 years ago. No, 20. How old am I? I'm 40. I'm 41. Sorry. 20-something years ago. I'm older than I thought. No.
That's cool. That would be 23. What's one of the wildest things, or at least recently? You've been playing that long, you may not have the wildest story. I don't know if you do.
I've done some catches where I'm running for the ball and I catch it and I do a flip somersault. That's about the best.
No cool way.
That's about the best.
Can you do that in practice, or does that only happen in the heat of the moment?
It's usually heat of the moment.
Joy, how long have you been playing softball?
I've always played softball or t-ball or everything ever since I was a little kid.
Oh, yeah. And you never had a major break?
I did in college. I didn't play in college.
Oh.
So, but other than that, I pretty much played straight through summer ball.
Cool.
Yeah. It's always been really fun.
What's one of, if not the wildest, or best plays you've made?
Well, today was a pretty good one.
Oh, yeah.
But that was fun. That was
you did a home run?
Yeah, I hit a home run today over the left fielder, just beyond our reach, bucking it around the bases. Who was in front of me?
I don't remember.
Veronica.
She was behind me. Who was?
I thought Veronica hit before you.
No, she hit behind me. Whoever it was in front of me, and she started on second base, and all I thought was run. Because as soon as I saw it going out, I knew it was over her head.
I think it was one of the Colligan girls.
And I knew, I'm going home. She better run.
She was running. It was one of the Colligan girls.
She was running hard. They were just running around the bases, and I got the third, and the catcher was in position to catch the ball. And I saw her reach for the ball, and I thought, oh, I have to slide. And so I started sliding down, but then her glove was up too high and was going to take me, so I tried to go over. And I ended up knocking the ball out of her glove with my head.
Oh.
Which was great, because then it was safe.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, it was a home run, which is awesome.
That is awesome.
But I think my very favorite play happened in ninth grade softball in the summer. We'd been playing a tournament, and it was like our seventh game, and it was really late at night. And I had like grit in my contacts and couldn't see, and I was playing shortstop. And our left field player, when we were running out the field, it was the last inning, and she said, "Joy, I'm so tired. Don't let any balls go by." And sure enough, the first batter came up, hit line drive. It was closer to second base. I don't know how I did it, but I dove and caught the ball, and I think that was my favorite play ever.
Cool.
Yeah.
And you have injuries now.
I do have injuries now.
I'm bleeding.
I have scars.
Is that from that home run?
Yeah, that's from the home run slide.
Awesome. And from injuries throughout
and
the year.
They don't heal. I went through 2 pairs of pants.
You know I'm going to get you that as a gift.
I know.
A new one that I have.
Totally. I need it.
And totally. Then you need to get me to put something on the back of my leg right here.
Yeah, I will. I'll get you one. I need like the double padded pants I stop ripping holes in them.
And when it does heal, if it ever does have a chance, you should tattoo it there so that...
Softball.
Ouch. Ouch.
A Band-Aid.
That's right. That'd be awesome. That's totally what I need.
Shannon, cool. Have you got a story for me? How long have you been playing?
Same as Joy even younger than T-ball. I played with my brothers at home in the backyard. And then I started T-ball. And actually, that's funny because I would always hit home runs in T-ball because I wouldn't stop running because I knew none of the kids could catch the ball.
Smart.
And so
it's all about tactics, isn't it?
And so the coaches would get frustrated because I was discouraging apparently the other children,
especially the boys.
Yeah, because I knew they couldn't catch it. I'm like, you've got to be kidding, because my brothers were like 2.5 and 5 years old, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I already knew how to play, and also I knew how to hit without a tee. So like having the tee there, I would just smack it. And then I would just run, because they would throw it over, and my coaches would be like, "Stop!" And I'm like, "Kidding? Like, I'm going home." And so they put me up into like the older kids bracket, so that I wouldn't discourage the other kids. And yeah, I just wouldn't listen, apparently.
Did you somebody teach you some of these things, or you just figured it out and watched and observed and got it?
I just watched. I mean, my brothers maybe taught me a little bit.
Yeah.
Because we'd play in the backyard, and we get, like, little groups together from the neighborhood.
Cool. Yeah.
And we'd have, like, you know, maybe 4 or 5 of us, maybe 6 out there in our backyard playing with a tennis ball or something.
Yeah.
And then once I was older, I played fast pitch, you know, like, as you move up. And I played catcher. I really loved that.
Mm.
Totally.
And then I only played until I was about 13. My parents moved up to North Idaho, and they actually didn't have fast pitch yet in North Idaho. I think they do now, but so like the Post Falls, Portland area.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had a break until I started playing slow pitch here about 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I started playing on a co-ed team with Mike.
You got any good stories recently?
Well, my favorite from this season.
Oh, good.
was the last game.
Just now? You mean this All-Stars or the last regular?
It was on Monday, was it? Last week?
Last Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. So I'm playing first, and some of the players on the team try to hit into right field, which is over my head.
Yeah.
And so I'm watching them, you know, kind of watching their feet or their stance and stuff and kind of trying to read what they're going to do. And so this one, I can tell she's going to hit there, so I'm kind of standing back almost close to the grass line because usually they can't get as much power over there. And this one lady, like, pops it up really high. And I just think, if I sprint, I can get there. And aren't you out there, Susie?
Yeah.
So I turn around. Like, I just look at the direction that's going. I turn around, and I just sprint, like, as fast as I can to where it's going.
With right field, yeah.
And, like, I'm just, like, going. And I look over my shoulder, and I'm like, I'm so close. It's like I only had, like, a foot that, you know, like, I couldn't make up. So I knew I had to jump. So I leapt for it, and my arm stretched out, and the ball goes, like, right next to my glove.
Right.
And then, since I hadn't really thought this through, other than if I sprint, I can get there, I landed right on my face.
It was beautiful.
It was amazing.
I just, like, boom, right on my face, and then, like, slid, and then I just laid there. And I knew Susie could get the ball, because I saw her feet coming as I was gliding through the air. Yeah.
I thought you knocked yourself out at first. You couldn't move.
I was just like, oh, that hurt. I did not think that through. But it was amazing, because, like, if only, like, over just, like, 5 inches, and it would have caught it.
Yeah.
So,
not even five. I mean, yeah.
But I bet it was very elegant.
Oh, no. No. What? She hit, and it was like, bam.
Yeah, I just landed.
But the run was elegant. The leap was like a good leap, but the smack.
But
on the ground,
then, yeah, like, it was just like right here on my eye, on my right hand. And I, like, just crunched.
Oh, yeah,
and then I just laid there, like, oh, that hurts. And then, well, I knew she was coming. You know, she had a better angle since I missed it. And, I don't know, though, but it was pretty fun because I think that those girls were thinking twice about hitting that direction after that.
I bet they were.
Because it was a lot farther than I actually thought.
Yeah. It was pretty far.
Yeah.
She turned and ran.
Could you have gotten it, Susie?
I don't think so. I think I was too far back.
He had a leaker.
T-ball as well.
Oh, did you?
I've been playing since I was, like, six.
Yeah.
Something.
The family business actually sponsored my team several years.
Oh, yeah.
I can't believe
what was the family business?
Hood State Tractor and Supply here in Moscow.
Cool.
My proudest moment is when I got a triple off of the Lady Bombers because they're the best team, and that's the team that she was just talking about, one of those girls. It was a very wonderful moment for me when I made it all the way to third. And I even talked to the umpire afterwards. I'm like, could I have made it? Could I have gone? He said, yeah, no. Yeah. You got to where you deserve to go. I'm like, yay,
you pushed it, huh?
I did.
Was it hard? I mean, were they...
They're always a hard team. I mean, we played them really good once. We went into the fifth inning, and it was, I think the score was 2-1.
2-1. I had the one run.
Okay. Yeah,
I just had to say that.
Yeah, we played them really good, and then we just stopped playing or something.
That was bold. And they started hitting right in all the gaps.
Mm-hmm. We just lost
Which
it.
Which I really wondered if they were just playing with us.
Mm-hmm. That's what Annie thought. Annie thought that they were just teasing us the whole first five innings.
It's your turn. How long have you been playing softball?
I've been playing 4 years. I played 1 year when...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I played 1 year when I was in the fourth grade, and then I didn't play again until I was 29.
Why didn't you play again?
My parents didn't have time for me to play again because they both played and my brother played. And so I was...
Did you get that?
The same
what?
Way.
Was it time for the girl to play?
Yes.
That was a conversation around the campfire. A group of all-star softball players from Moscow, Idaho, and Pullman, Washington. Now I'm going to give you a musical piece that's right in the theme of the show. It comes from Heidi Muller, singer and songwriter. You can see more about Heidi, and you can purchase this CD and others at HeidiMuller.com. That's M-U-L-L-E-R. The song is I Like Baseball.
Summertime of 61, every Saturday I take my own
SpaghettiOs for dinner and I'd stay. My granddad was a quiet man doing crosswords in the chair, but he'd become a rabid fan with baseball on the air. We listened to the radio, we watched it on TV. Can't say I understood, but it was magical to me. Especially the Yankees, we cheered their every move, and all those hours of Mickey Mantle finally would prove that I like baseball, I watch it on the tube. I buy my tickets at the Dome, go in and come unglued. I've been to Dodger Stadium, seen the Sox at Old Fenway. Oh, I like baseball, even though I do not play. In New York, who seemed to understand. One day he came to see us with presents in his hand. He gave me not your usual doll, but cast in plaster of Paris, his bobbing head upon a spring, my idol Roger Maris. But we girls weren't taught to throw the ball the way that pitchers do. No matter how I swung the bat, I only hit a few. Projectiles falling from the sky put fear into my heart. Too slow to run the bases well, it doomed me from the start. But I like baseball, I watch it on the tube. I buy my tickets at the Dome, go in and come unglued. I've been to Dodger Stadium, seen the Sox at Old Fenway. Oh, I like baseball, even though I cannot play. However, can you tell me just who is to blame that not since the 50s have women played the game? If they ever get a commissioner, the first thing she should do is put us back in uniform and we'll play hardball too. I like baseball, I watch it on the tube. I buy my tickets at the Dome, go in and come unglued. I've been to Dodger Stadium, seen the Sox at Old Fenway. Oh, I like baseball, even though they won't let us play. Someday I'll be in heaven or some such place above, and at the end of my outstretched wing will be a fielder's glove. I'll be batting homers completely out of sight. Me and Randy Johnson will pitch at the speed of light. 'Cause I like baseball, I watch it on the tube. I buy my tickets at the Dome, go in and come unglued. I've been to Dodger Stadium, seen the Sox. Even though I do not play, oh, I like baseball, even though I do not play.
This has been Yin Radio. Thanks for joining me today. If you want to hear past shows or podcast this show, you can do that at yinradio.org. And yinradio.org is also where you can sign up for our electronic newsletter. Find out what's going on at Yin Radio. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. Let us know what you think of Yin Radio, for good or for bad. What would you like to hear more of or less of on the show? What are we missing that just needs to be covered? Share your story and your voice. Drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio@v as in voice, p as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, in Moscow, Idaho. Installments for this show were produced by Sandy Billings. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host, and thanks for joining me. Until next week. And this has been an encore edition of Yin Radio from this summer, with some hints of summer for these winter days, and of course some hints of cold in some of these stories as well. Glad you could join me.